Beacon Press Audio presents School Close, a collective memoir of Black student witness by Jarvis R. Givens. This audiobook is narrated by Sean Scott. Published by Beacon Press Audio, 2019. Preface. School Clothes and the Black Vernacular. I got shoes. You got shoes. All God's chillin' got shoes. When I get to heaven, gonna put on my shoes and walk all over God's heaven. I got a robe, you got a robe. All God's chillin' got a robe. When I get to heaven, gonna put on my robe and shout all over God's heaven. All God's chillin' got shoes. African American spiritual. When I was a young student, my family referred to school clothes, uniforms or clothing purchased with the specific intent of being worn to school. Shopping for school clothes before the new academic year was an occasion of major significance. If I stayed over at a cousin's house between Monday and Friday, I had to pack some school clothes, just as I knew to pack some church clothes if I visited my grandmother for the weekend. When my cousins and I came home in the afternoons, we had to take off our school clothes before going outside, and were usually instructed to put on some play clothes, or specifically, play shoes. We were not to wear newer shoes or good shoes reserved for school or events where we had to look our best. We needn't worry about play clothes getting dirty or play shoes getting scuffed. They were already, by definition, messed up. Embedded in such routines and usage were values about school, church, and play, although this knowledge was rarely explicitly articulated. These sartorial politics reflect distinct ways of being in African-American vernacular culture, a culture held and cultivated internally, where Black people express their own aesthetic judgments, their own ways of seeing the world, its history, and its meanings. And those sartorial politics are not unique to my family, nor are they new. As Monica Miller writes, the spiritual has always had a sartorial dimension for Black people in America. While churches have been a major site for these sartorial practices, schools have long been a locus for expressions of Black spirituality and sites where African Americans have worked on ourselves as canvases of representation, to borrow from Stuart Hall. Immediately following emancipation, Black communities all over the United States went to school as a means of putting distance between themselves and the conditions of a slave past that constantly threatened to contaminate their lives as free people. I found accounts of students dressing up for school and for freedom in the 19th and 20th centuries to be particularly beautiful and endearing. I encountered portraits of students in the first days of freedom trying to look the part. Take E.D. Tilghman, for instance. After this formerly enslaved young man was admitted to Hampton Institute in July 1868, he asked for time to get his affairs in order. He made only $5.50 per week, but he was determined to find a way to pay for school and the appropriate clothing. "You may rely on my coming," he assured them, "for I am coming, without I dies or sickness prevents, as soon as I get my clothes. Look out for me." Black students dressed in ways that made them and their people feel proud, striving to put on attire commensurate with their mission. More than raiment, school clothes were something akin to ceremonial garb. At least, that is how I think of it when I reflect on the Black farmers near Maysville, South Carolina, who held high ambitions for one of their own, a Miss Mary Jane McLeod Bethune. In October 1888, they halted all work operations to send a 13-year-old Mary Jane off to Scotia Seminary. Some gifted her with clothes for the journey. "We used to have little cracker boxes. We kept our clothes in them, so my father went down and got me a little trunk," Bethune recalled. "Some neighbors knitted a pair of stockings, some gave me a little linsey dress, little aprons, this, that, and the other. And when that October day came, I can see myself now, going down to Maysville to take the train for the first time in my life." The Black farmers stopped work that afternoon, got out the wagons, mules, ox carts, some riding, some walking. "They were going to Maysville to put me on the train to go to school," she recounted. Mary Jane was their proxy, a young student striving to make freedom a real thing for herself and her people. Bethune's story about school clothes is a favorite of mine, in part because it was the first to jump out at me. I stumbled on the anecdote while reading an interview with Bethune in the archives at Fisk University. I was supposed to be searching for Carter G. Woodson in the papers of Southern Black teachers and Black teacher organizations for my first book, Fugitive Pedagogy, But as always, my mind started wandering around in the archive. And such wandering often leads me to wondering about new questions, new traces. Often I see things that have nothing to do with what I am searching for, but I find myself unable to turn away from them. After sitting with Bethune's story of those black farmers stopping work to send her off to school and providing her with new clothes, as well as her descriptions of the particular articles of clothing, I decided to take what I had seen with me. My eye would catch more and more sartorial metaphors in black student narratives. Such stories appear post-emancipation, but they are intimately connected to African-American experiences during slavery. School clothes became part and parcel of African-Americans' efforts to undo the harms inflicted on black youth during slavery and its afterlives. A young Booker T. Washington helps elucidate this point. Washington named the wearing of a flax shirt as the most trying ordeal he endured as a slave boy in Virginia. He explained, "It was common to use flax as part of the clothing for the slaves. That part of the flax from which our clothing was made was largely the refuse, which of course was the cheapest and roughest part." Washington detailed his memory of that dreadful slave shirt. "I can scarcely imagine any torture, except perhaps the pulling of a tooth, that is equal to that caused by putting on a new flax shirt for the first time. It is almost equal to the feeling that one would experience if he had a dozen or more chestnut burrs or 100 small pinpoints in contact with his flesh. The fact that my flesh was soft and tender added to the pain." To mitigate the pain of that awful shirt, Washington's older brother, John, performed one of the most generous acts he had ever heard of one slave relative doing for another. Whenever Booker was forced to wear a new flax shirt, John offered to wear it first for several days until the shirt was broken in. Washington was about 9 years old when slavery ended, but this experience did more than mark his flesh. The memory left an impression on him. Black youth like Tilghman, Bethune, and Washington covered themselves in new clothes to go to school after emancipation, often with the care of parents and community, seeking redress for the stolen childhoods of years past, as historian Wilma King described the realities of enslaved youth. School clothes were often armor, forms of protection just as much as assertions of dignity and self-worth for young black people whose childhoods continued to be threatened even after slavery was legally abolished. Quite often, black learners were elaborately adorned with decorations on the decorations, to borrow from Zora Neale Hurston. Some enjoyed the pleasure derived from the luxury of choice and self-fashioning. Annette Gordon Reed details this in her memory from the first grade, when her great-great-aunt, who was born on a Texas farm in the late 19th century, gifted her several new dresses as she embarked on the journey of desegregating an all-white school in Conroe, Texas, in the mid-1960s. Gordon Reed writes, "My great-great-aunt bought boxes and boxes of dresses, tights, blouses, skirts, and hats from the most upscale department store in the city at the time, Sackowitz, making sure I was dressed to the nines was her contribution to the civil rights movement." Gordon Reed's experience was shared by many African-American female students who made up most of the black youth to stand on the front line of school desegregation. They were often the first students chosen by their communities or to volunteer. Black students' will to adorn was a disruptive force, challenging past and present threats seeking to violate their dignity as learners and as human beings. African-Americans' deep reverence for education expressed itself in how they showed up to learn. And while rigid social norms about clothing could certainly be limiting, aesthetic and sartorial politics, acts of adorning the body could also be about soulcraft, cultivating an internal vision and virtues that one might express externally in the world. For a great many of them, education was the starting place for thinking up and creating that world, where everyone could have what they needed to live a life of dignity and human flourishing, a world where they could pursue the desires of their hearts without being barred because of who they were. Knowing beauty to be a method, black students dressed themselves in dreams that emerged over generations of African Americans striving within the veil. This book is about that journey, and black students bearing witness to it. Such recollections were intimate encounters for me. I experienced them as connected to my own identity as a learner and a researcher, and I found myself drawing on personal experiences to interpret the stories unveiled in school clothes, just as I have done in this preface. And I quickly learned that I wasn't the only one to find such stories familiar, as evidenced by the archive of historical sources informing this book. I found myself combing through.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?